Tom O'Milhoringe Kyo. How are you today? I hope this finds you well, staying healthy. The Go Show we're going to start today is called The Hero of the World. It's an interesting title. Not sure about the translation, however. This is a continuing story. This is a letter written by Nichiren to Shijo Kingo once again. Shijo Kingo is at a point in his life and career with Lord Emma where he's been, a lot of people are trying to depose him, get him out of there, show him in an ill light to his employer, Lord Emma. And Emma gets, he gets influenced from time to time, and he threatens Shijo Kingo or asks him to write oaths that say, just forget about Nichiren and all will be fine, or if you don't, or just get out of here. And then he gets sick, and Shijo Kingo is the only one who knows anything about medicine, so he clamors for Shijo Kingo to help him, and then he gets well, and then he's, Shijo Kingo enjoys his favor, and then the other samurais around him plot to make him look bad or say he's done things he haven't done, and so on and so forth, right? We saw this in the letter from Yoritomo just recently, and this is a follow-up, it's mixed. The dates and the timing is a little odd, but I think together with other letters, we can put together a scenario here. So this letter, rather than being the petition, as it were, with letter from Yoritomo, this is more a letter directed to Shijo Kingo himself with a lesson about something I've talked about quite a few times because it comes up a lot in Nichiren's day, is the position of Buddhism versus government. And throughout, throughout the world, but certainly in Shogunate Japan, and prior, you know, when you had emperors and great kings and leaders of countries, they were imbued almost like messengers of whatever gods were being worshipped at the time. And Japan is no less a mystical country than others. They're named the land of the rising sun because of their worship of the sun goddess is kind of their spirit animal, if you will. The great Bodhisattva Hachiman calls back to folklore about a certain person who is then achieves this sainted state, if you will, of Bodhisattva. Not the Buddhism of Shakyamuni per se, but a Buddhist school nonetheless, right? So anyway, there's all this mysticism and mixed with power. You know, if you're a mystic, then you have power, and if you say something, then everyone follows what you say because of this imposed mystical power, right? The world still runs like this today in many respects. Some countries are really, really steeped in these religious traditions to the point where the people, the populace, don't know any other way to behave. Their whole livelihood, their whole day-to-night existence is centered around this traditional worshiping mental oppression. And this has been in different conditions in different countries all over the world. So with Buddhism, Buddhism trashes all of that mysticism. It's all, you are in control of your life's expression. There is no after death. There is no reincarnation. There is not all this other stuff you need to preoccupy your life with. What is happening now is what you're responsible for and what you control and create. And you can see this clearly if you see the vast process of life as something that is not only much larger than you, but something that you singularly can perceive. And there's a tremendous amount of empowerment. I hate that word because it's overused, but truly the power center, instead of being somewhere outside of you in Buddhism, in Shakyamuni's Buddhism, certainly in Nichiren's doctrine of how to practice Shakyamuni's Buddhism, the Lotus Sutra as the ultimate teaching, is all about recognizing, knowing, realizing that that center is within you, not outside of you. But that's very threatening to the powers of societal constructs of power and centers of power, and certainly the elite, right? So to a samurai, this must have been especially difficult to understand, coming from a history of obeisance to an emperor, and now being in itself seizing power and saying, we don't need no emperor, we are the power, the shogunate, right? It represents quite a paradigm shift in thinking. And so the shogunate continues a ritualistic mysticism, if you will, through physical rituals and rites, emulating in a way a religious life, but in a hierarchical, authoritarian manifestation, without commanding the gods, as it were, but actually commanding the gods incarnate as they are imbued with their own authoritarian power. It's a transitional thing. It's a little odd, and parts of it are very grounded in the martial arts and the, and you know, assassinations and so forth. It's very, very bound to human existence, and that is bound by these traditions of deep, abiding filial relationships. You know, everything from seppuku and honor and respect, and those are the qualities, very societal qualities, that are deeply endowed with this aesthetic of power, right? And then Buddhism is this adjunct thing that this power structure uses as a sort of a righteous empowering feature of their earthly existence. It's a strange marriage. But, you know, there's always these philosophical components, whether it be religions in most cases, or, you know, a call to capitalism or democracy. These words are used for a sort of a justifying stamp on the authoritarian regime. And so the meanings get muddy and lost. And so Nichiren spends a lot of time in this letter defining the difference between, you know, Shijo Kingo is caught between these two worlds in a way. He's a very filial, you know, retainer of his lord. He's a samurai. He's a head samurai. He's very steeped in these traditions and hierarchies and you know, models of power. And then he's also an avid study of Buddhism, and especially through Nichiren, who's the ultimate scholar, right? So he's often torn. He recognizes he's an assassin who takes life, and as a Buddhist, that's an abhorrent thing for him to be doing. So he's of two minds, two worlds, and he's wrestling with how he should behave with his boss's behavior, let alone those other samurai that want to take him down. You know, what am I to do? So Nichiren writes this letter, I think, to give him some guidance, to recognize the difference, and to be aware of what he's navigating. So, here we go. Having glanced through your letter, I feel as relieved as if the day had finally broken after a long night, or as if I had returned home after a long journey. So obviously he's gotten a note from Shijo Kingo that things are settled, Emma was sick and he was able to bring him to health and now he's in his good graces, but things are very volatile, right? Buddhism primarily concerns itself with victory or defeat, while secular authority is based on the principle of reward and punishment. So let me just say victory or defeat again. These are words that a samurai would use, right? And very closely tied to the ideas of reward and punishment. Now we're dealing with a translation, so I want to pick that apart a little bit. Victory or defeat in Buddhism is whether or not victory is your proper practice of Buddhism to liberate yourself from suffering, or what we in the West would call happiness. That's a very amorphous, very poorly defined term, but happiness in Buddhism being freed from our attachments and those things that cause us, that we cause ourselves suffering about, distress, whatever. Hopefully by now you have a good idea of that definition. Happiness isn't really the greatest word. It's really the liberation from our self-causes of suffering. And defeat would be succumbing to our sufferings, right? Succumbing to our desires and our rampant cravings and thoughts and letting that take us over. So in Buddhism, that's either you're practicing correctly or you're not. You're making that choice. You practice correctly, you lead yourself to enlightenment and liberation. You don't practice correctly, or worse, you practice correct teachings, but you practice them with spite or wrong attitude, wrong intent. Remember, we talk about this all the time. Or erroneously, you go this way and that. You spurn your very freedom, liberty, liberation from suffering. So that's victory or defeat, right? Victory or defeat in terms of your personal best life. Whereas the government is about reward or punishment. So this is from outside of you. See the difference? You're rewarded for your great assassinations or you're punished for having missed the mark. See, this is an authority being put upon you, government. Buddhism is the only authority is your own happiness and your practice and dedication, resolve toward it, attitude, intent, right? For this reason, a Buddha is looked up to as the hero of the world. In other words, attaining that full liberation makes you an amazing, fully realized conscious being, right? An experience of the all there is to potential in your life, in life in general. While a king is called the one who rules at his will, so in other words, imposes his desires, his cravings, or her cravings upon the populace. India is called the land of the moon, and our country the land of the sun. Of the 80,000 countries in the land of Jambudvipa, in other words, all countries in the world, India is one of the largest, and Japan one of the smallest. When it comes to the auspiciousness of their names, however, India ranks second and Japan first. Nationalism. Sun being superior to moon, follow. Buddhism began in the land of the moon. It will reside in the land of the sun. It is in the natural course of events that the moon appears in the west and travels eastward, while the sun proceeds from the east to the west. This truth is as inalterable as the fact that a magnet attracts iron, or that the ivory plant is nourished by the sound of thunder. Who could possibly deny it? So he's placing the seed of Buddhism firmly in Japan at this point, at this time, right? You can add that, by the way, to earlier videos. I've tried to explain why we chant Myoho Renge Kyo rather than Mohochikwan or Sadharma Pundarika Sutra and so on and so forth. Let us examine how Buddhism came to Japan. Our country was first under the seven reigns of the heavenly deities and then under the five reigns of the earthly deities. Their reigns were followed by the age of human sovereigns, the first being Emperor Jimmu. The 13th emperor was Kimei, who reigned for 32 years. Now this, you can research all of this, of course, but this is what I was alluding to earlier from deification of leaders like pharaohs and certain kings and leaders or czars and so on and so forth, down to a little bit more human and then finally to authoritarian structures, right? In those days, there were the state was called Pakchi to the west of this country. It was under the suzerainty, not sure I understand that one, of the Japanese emperor and was governed by a king named Xiongmyong. When the king made his annual tribute to Japan on the 13th day with the cyclical sign Kanototori of the 10th month of the 13th year of Emperor Kimei's reign, 552, the year with the cyclical sign Mizunoe Saru, he sent along with it a gilded bronze image of Shakyamuni Buddha, a number of Buddhist scriptures, and also monks and nuns. Overjoyed, the emperor sought counsel from his ministers as to whether or not the nation should worship the Buddha or of the Western countries. The great minister Inameo of the Soga clan said, quote, "All the countries of the West worship this Buddha. Why should Japan alone deny him?" However, the chief minister Okoshi of the Mononobo clan, Nakatomi no Kamako, and others advised the emperor, saying, "The sovereign who rules over our country has traditionally performed rites throughout the four seasons of the year in honor of heaven and earth, the deities of the land and of grain, and numerous other deities. If we alter this custom in favor of the deity of the West, our native deities will be angered." Unable to decide, the emperor decreed that the great minister Soga alone should worship the Buddha by way of a trial. Let's let him do it and see what happens. And that no one else should do so. Soga was exceedingly glad to receive this decree. "Sure, I'll do it." He took the image of Shakyamuni Buddha to his residence at a place called Ohada and enshrined it there. To the surprise and outrage of the chief minister Mononobe, who didn't want it, it challenged his authority, right? He didn't want that. At that time, a terrible epidemic broke out in Japan and killed the majority of the populace, like a plague. Since it seemed as though the entire nation would perish, the chief minister, Mononobe, took this opportunity to declare to the emperor that the Buddha image should be destroyed. See, clearly, that's what brought all this on us, right? The emperor concurred and commanded that Buddhism, a foreign religion, be discarded immediately. The chief minister, Mononobe, acting on the emperor's behalf, confiscated the statue, heated it in a charcoal fire, and smashed it with a hammer. He raised the Buddha image half, and flogged the monks and nuns. It's a little extreme. Then, although the sky was cloudless, a gale blew and rain fell. The imperial palace was consumed in a fire that descended from heaven. All three men, the emperor, Mononobe, and Soga, fell ill in the epidemic. Each suffered excruciating agony as though he were being mangled or burned alive. Mononobe finally died, while the emperor and Soga barely recovered. From that time, 19 years passed without anyone taking a resolute mind in Buddhism. The 31st emperor, Bidatsu, was the second son of Kimei. He reigned for 14 years aided by the ministers of the left and right. One of them was a son of the chief minister Mononobe no Okoshi, Yuge no Moriya, who had succeeded to his father's position. The other was a son of the great minister Soga no Iname, Soga no Umako, who also assumed his father's position. It was during Emperor Bidatsu's reign that Prince Shotoku was born. He was a son of Emperor Yomei and a nephew of Bidatsu. One day, in the second month of the year, when the prince was 2 years old, he faced the east, extended his third finger, and chanted, "Hail Buddha," whereupon the Buddha's ashes materialized in his palm. This was the first time that anyone in Japan had invoked the name of Shakyamuni Buddha. It makes you wonder what actually happened, right? But obviously there was an ominous moment here. When the prince was only 8 years old, he proclaimed, quote, "Those who in the latter age worship the image of the sage of the West, Shakyamuni Buddha, will forestall calamities and receive benefits. Those who despise it will invite disasters and have their lives shortened," end quote. So this is obviously the overarching meaning of the story, right? Whether these events are actual or not, I simply haven't had time to dig into these, but some of you who may be very good historians, certainly somebody like Jacqueline Stone, who's written books about this era, would know actual facts about this. So that might be an interesting thing to look into. And I would recommend Jacqueline Stone's books on this medieval era of Japanese history and the years before it. At any rate, the symbolism is not lost on us, right? We see the point here. When the prince was only 8 years old, he proclaimed, "Those who despise it will invite disasters and have their lives shortened." Hearing this, the chief minister Manobe no Moriya and others said in anger, "The Sogas have been worshipping the deity of a foreign land in violation of the imperial decree." Epidemics still raged incessantly, nearly wiping out the entire populace. Mononobe no Moriya reported this to the emperor. The emperor issued a decree, as they are wont to do, which stated, quote, "Soga no Umako has been upholding Buddhism. Practice of this religion must cease," end quote. In compliance with the imperial command, Moriya, together with Nakatomi no Katsumi, marched upon the temple. "I'm going to put an end to this again, just like my daddy did." There, they demolished the hall and Padita, burned and destroyed the Buddha image, and set fire to the temple. Repetition. They stripped the monks and nuns of their supplices and punished them with whips. After this incident, the emperor, as well as Moriya and Umako, fell ill in an epidemic. All three said that they felt as though they were being burned alive or hacked to pieces. Moreover, boils called smallpox appeared all over their bodies. Now we get a clue as to what the epidemic was. It's horrific. Umako, lamenting in anguish, said, quote, "Still, we should worship the three treasures," end quote. The emperor commanded that Umako alone should do so and that no one else must follow suit. Overjoyed, Umako had a monastery built and there worshipped the three treasures. The emperor, and you can look up the three treasures on threefoldlotus.com and get a full write-up on what those are. The Emperor Bidatsu finally died on the 15th day of the 8th month of the year when Prince Shotoku was 14. Yomei became 32nd emperor and reigned for 2 years, not very long. He was the son of Kimei and the father of Shotoku. In the 4th month of the 2nd year of his reign, 587, cyclical sign Hinoto Hitsuji, he fell ill in an epidemic. Thereupon, he expressed a desire to embrace the three treasures. Soga no Umaku insisted that the imperial wish be honored and finally brought a monk called Toyokuni into the imperial palace. Mononobe no Moriya and others flew into a rage, and in their fury swore to invoke a curse upon the emperor. At length, the emperor passed away. Now, just for it's an aside, but just to help you picture this world situation, around this time is when Chi'i was formulating his Threefold Lotus Sutra practice as the ultimate practice of Buddhism. He was adjusting the canon, weeding out the erroneous additions to Shakyamuni's sermons, putting them in proper order, identifying the five periods of teaching, and basically establishing a new school on Mount Tendai, which is why it's called Tendai Buddhism. All right. This is around the same time period. Tendai is just starting to do this in China as this upheaval is going on in Japan. It's an interesting point. In other words, Tendai Buddhism had not reached Japan by this point. They were practicing earlier forms of Mahayana, provisional forms. And they were, this was coming from Korea, right? That would be Pakche. And this was the path of Buddhism from China to Korea into Japan. Okay, moving on. In the fifth month of that year, Moriya and his clan entrenched themselves at his residence and in Shibukawa and assembled a large number of troops there. So, this minister looks like he was preparing a coup. Prince Shotoku and Umaku advanced on the enemy's position and fought. The fifth, sixth, and seventh months saw a total of four encounters. The prince lost the first three. Before the fourth battle took place, he offered a meditation and vowed that he would build a stupa for the preservation of the thus come one Shakyamuni's ashes and also construct Shiten-no-ji Temple of the Four Heavenly Kings. Umako similarly pledged that he would erect a temple and enshrine the image of Shakyamuni Buddha that had been sent from Pakche. I thought this image was lost earlier, but no matter. When the fighting began, Moriya shouted at the prince, "It is not I, but the deity of my ancestors, the great deity enshrined at Futsu, who shoots this arrow." The arrow flew far and struck the prince's armor. The prince responded by calling out, "It is not I, but the four heavenly kings who shoot this arrow." Then he had a courtier named Tomi no Ichi let fly the arrow. It traveled a great distance and struck Moriya in the chest. Hata no Kawakatsu rushed to the spot and severed Moriya's head from his body. This incident took place during the interval between Yomei's passing and Shushun's ascension to the throne. So he's quoting actual historical events, albeit colorfully. After Shushun became, not that he's making these things up, these would be stories that would be recountings of the actual battles. So he's just being true to the documentation of what has occurred, okay? So didn't mean to mislead you there. Prince Shotoku built Shiten-no-ji Temple, in which he placed the thus come one Shakyamuni's ashes. Umaku, I don't know how he got the ashes, they're not telling us that. Umaku erected a temple called Ganjo-ji, where he worshipped the image of Shakyamuni Buddha, the Lord of Teachings, which had been sent from Pakchi. Here, it must be pointed out in passing that the most appalling fraud in the world today is that of the statue of the Thus Come One, Amida. Allegedly, the original object of devotion of the Zenkoji Temple. So while we're at it, let me remind you that this other weirdness is going on, right? It was because of their enmity toward Shakyamuni Buddha that the three emperors, as well as the members of the Monobu clan, perished. Prince Shotoku had an image of Shakyamuni Buddha cast and enshrined it in Ganjo-ji. This is the object of devotion now enshrined in Tachibana Dera Temple. It was the first statue of Shakyamuni Buddha ever to be made in Japan. In China, in the seventh year of Yongping, in the year 64, a long time ago, the second emperor of the latter Han dynasty, Emperor Ming, dreamed of a man of gold. He thereupon dispatched 18 emissaries, including the scholars Cha Yin and Wang Tsun, to India to seek Buddhism. As a result, in the 10th year of Yongping, cyclical sign Hinoto-u, two sages of central India, Kashyapa Matanga and Chu Fa-lan, were brought to China and accorded the highest esteem. Thousands of adherents of Confucianism and Taoism, schools that had been, up until then, presided over all imperial rites, resented this and lodged a complaint with the emperor. The emperor decreed that an open debate would be held on the 15th day of the first month of the 14th year of Yongping. Overjoyed, the Taoists erected an altar for 100 Chinese deities as their objects of devotion. The two sages from India had as their objects of devotion the Buddha's ashes, a painting of Shakyamuni Buddha, and five sutras. As was customary in their rituals performed before the emperor, the Taoists brought in the scriptures of their school, as well as the three records, the five canons, and the writings of the two sages and the three kings, piled some of them with firewood and set them ablaze. In similar rites in the past, these books had always withstood the flames. But this time, they were reduced to ashes. Oops. Others, which were placed in water, had previously floated on the surface, but now sank to the bottom. The Taoist called out for demons to appear, but to no avail. Unbearably humiliated, Chu Shanxin, Fei Su Tsai, and others died of shame. That's some profound shame. When the two Indian sages preached Buddhism, the Buddha's ashes ascended to heaven and they there radiated a light so brilliant that it eclipsed the sun. The Buddha in the paintings emitted a light from between his eyebrows. More than 600 Taoists, including Lu Tsung, Hui Tsung, finally capitulated and entered the Buddhist monkhood. Within 30 days of this confrontation, they built 10 temples of Buddhism. Now, very fanciful stories, but remember, these are stories from, 64 AD. I mean, these, and from China, steeped in mysticism. Confucianism and Taoist theories were very earthbound and very, actually, in many ways, complementary to Buddhism, but, there was a lot of, how shall I say, there was a lot of reverence paid to these teachers and their teachings as being, they're being imbued with special knowledge. And so rather than inculcating the teachings into their own lives, the populace basically worshipped Confucius and Taoist teachers and tried to follow their advice. They still weren't inculcating these teachings into their own realizations. You see that there's still a hierarchical, authoritarian thinking in place amongst the populace and certainly amongst the teachers. And Buddhism just won't tolerate that. So this is always the confrontation of Buddhism. And, you know, those fanciful stories are really an illustration, if you will, of how the debate that took place was very tremendously one-sided, that all of the documentation that these teachers brought to prove that they were superior just fell apart under the auspices of Buddhist teachings. So it's illustrated in this very World of Warcraft kind of, you know, or if you're an old timer like me, Dungeons and Dragons, right? The powers and all of this. Anyway, I digress. Thus, Shakyamuni Buddha is perfectly just in administering reward and punishment. This translation is a little confusing, isn't it? Because we already established that Buddhism is about, what were the two words? Government was identified as reward and punishment, whereas Buddhism was regarded as, my memory is terrible. I think it's important to point this out, though, because I don't want you to be confused. Victory or defeat, right? So this Buddhism is about victory or defeat, right? Are you enlightening your life, or are you working against your own enlightenment? So for Shakyamuni to perfectly just in administering reward or punishment, which is the domain of governance, that's a slippery slope. I think I would have written that as that Shakyamuni Buddha, which is our awakening to our Buddha-ness, establishes our victory or our defeat, whether our attitude and our intent is toward our awakening or against it or misleading it or whatever, rather than reward and punishment, right? But let's read on. As I mentioned earlier, that's why this translation isn't. Because the three emperors and the two subjects became enemies of the thus come one Shakyamuni, they lost their lives and fell into the evil paths in their next existence. So in their future moments, right? I wonder if I should rewrite that paragraph because it's so glaringly opposite and wrong. I think you'll understand it, though, now that I've discussed it with you, why that's a problem of translation, I believe. Our own age is not unlike theirs. So now we come back to the now. The Taoists Chu and Fei of China and Moria in Japan, by relying on the major and minor deities of their respective countries, became enemies of Shakyamuni Buddha. But since these deities themselves follow the Buddha, those practitioners were all brought to ruin. These present times are exactly like theirs. The image I mentioned earlier that came from Pakche is that of Shakyamuni Buddha. Nevertheless, monks of the other schools have deceived the Japanese people by calling it Amida Buddha. Oh, they actually renamed the honorific statues that were sent from Korea and said, no, that's not Shakyamuni, it's Amida. Which you and I both know, Amida is a construct of Shakyamuni's, used as a teaching tool, not an actual human realized Buddhahood. The only person who's done that is Shakyamuni. It's his teaching. It's so crazy. Okay, in other words, they have replaced Shakyamuni with another Buddha. There is a difference between the Taoist and Moria on the one hand and our contemporary monks on the other, in that the former preferred deities to a Buddha, while the latter replaced one Buddha with another. However, they are alike in that they all abandoned Shakyamuni Buddha. There is no doubt, therefore, that our country will be ruined. This is a teaching that has never yet been revealed. Keep it strictly to yourself. Yeah, could you imagine with this teaching that Nichiren has just shared with Shijokengo, if Shijokengo, oh yeah, well, and spouted, they'd behead him on the spot. But it's an interesting foray into the folklore and the history from India to China to Korea to Japan, and how there's precedent for what's going on in Japan today. This Nichiren is always trying to show to people, whether it's Shijo Kengo or the elite, the rulers, or the populace at large, that what is happening today has precedent. There is a way to get out of this mess. And it is correct practice of Buddhism, Lotus Sutra, Myoho Renge Kyo, right? Where are we time-wise? I think that's long enough before I close. How much more is there to this Gosho? So it's kind of an interesting letter in that it uses quite a bit of history. Yeah, we'll finish this in the next one. Actual history and accounts of history, albeit sometimes a bit fanciful. I think you can get the gist of it, which again, I remind you, is what Shakyamuni himself said. Don't get stuck on the words, look for the meaning, right? So the words are interesting, and we can kind of see how historical records from different countries and cultures can tell us a lot, but may not be word for word accurate accounts. Like we would like to see in the West, right? Very diagnostic in particular, although that happens later in history. These early records of earlier civilizations illustrate rather than document. But I mean, the point is there. It's very clear. If you allow yourself to enjoy the illustration, if you will, and get from it the meaning that it so desperately wants to convey. All right, so thank you again for being here. I really appreciate all your support, those who watch these videos. How's Davey 504 saying? Oh yeah, slap that like button. Anyway, thank you for being here. Those of you who can donate to participate through Patreon or through PayPal, thank you so much for your support. We all appreciate it. And don't forget to download the podcast at the Buddhahood Podcast. One day I'll say that all in one shot. It'll just come out. The Buddhahood Podcast. See, there it happened. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. See you next time.